ignoring the relevant holdings of Mangus versus Guerra and misapplying N. Ray Bass, the Court of Appeals erred, one, in holding that the executive owes no duty to the non-executive co-tenant to lease minerals, and two, that the executive, in order to enhance the value of his surface estate, can ensure that the dominant mineral estate is never developed for leasing purposes. In Mangus versus Guerra, both the Court of Appeals below and the respondents like to focus on the sensational act of Mangus leasing his co-tenant's minerals to himself, and this court's holding that when a lease is executed, the executive must obtain every benefit for the non-executive that the executive obtains for himself. But the court's view of Mangus is limited there. Eastland does not go on to understand that Mangus says much more than applying what the duties with regard to actually having executed a lease. Mangus versus Guerra tells us, and we know from Mangus versus Guerra, that pre-leasing activities, including the failure to execute an oil and gas lease when there is a reasonable opportunity to do so, is also a breach of the executive duty.
Does the fact that you can have like horizontal drilling, does that impact your argument at all on the breaching?
No, Justice Guzman, it does not for two reasons. First of all, there is no evidence in this record that all of the minerals that exist within the subject property can be reached by horizontal drilling. And the other problem with horizontal drilling is that assumes that these mineral owners have the right to use neighboring surface. There is no obligation at law for a neighboring surface owner to allow his neighbors access to their minerals through his surface. And so that was not an issue that was addressed in Mangus versus Guerra and is not something that is available for the co-tenant owners here.
Why would you buy the executive rights if you have to do whatever is in the best interest of the mineral interest owner?
The reason that you buy the executive rights is so that you can have some control over how the surface is used, is the first reason.
How would you maintain that if you've got to lease the property?
Well, that's the beauty of the Mangus duty. The Mangus duty says that you have to lease the property if an average landowner looking out for his own interests would do so. It's a reasonable standard. And so the idea that the executive duty and oil and gas development and the surface cannot all coexist is a false premise that has been argued by the respondents and articulated by the Court of Appeals. Throughout the state of Texas, oil and gas development and surface use coexist. They coexist rurally and they coexist urbanly. There are oil and gas developments that exist within subdivisions, even within large cities. The beauty of the Mangus charge is that it allows the executive rights holder to have some control over how the surface is used, so long as that control does not reach to the level of unreasonableness and self-dealing.
Well, so you say that the someone cannot buy the executive rights to preclude development of the property.
That's correct, Your Honor. You cannot.
He just, for whatever reason, it's his sentimental value or it's where he grew up or he's crazy or something. He doesn't want the money. He doesn't want to drill the property. So he says, sell me the executive rights. You say that can't be done.
That's correct. In fact, this very issue was addressed by Lee Jones in his 1948 Texas Law Review article that is cited by this court in its footnote in N. Ray Bass to explain the difference between a non-participating royalty interest and a mineral interest. And it's very interesting that even back in 1948, Lee Jones says, it is believed that the courts will not tolerate an arbitrary refusal to exercise the exclusive leasing privileges. And
But it's not arbitrary. I mean, he's got a reason. He wants to preserve the surface free of drilling.
If the reason, though, is putting the subservient surface estate over the rights of the dominant mineral estate, then the executive has breached his duty.
Does it become a breach or arbitrary when there is a now a value when it's known now that they're very valuable versus when they were first transferred? Or is that what prevents it? Or is it, couldn't there be a situation where it wasn't arbitrary, where you just decided to preserve them because you wanted to?
Well, the decision where it would become arbitrary would be if there is, like the record in this case, where we know that the executive takes a sign and sticks it in the ground and says, lessees need not apply. That is the result of the restrictive covenants. So the case before the court now is not one of dealing with the nuances of what is reasonable or not reasonable under the circumstances, because on this undisputed record, we know that but for the restrictive covenants, the minerals could have been leased. The Mangus charge allows a fact finder, if there are fact questions, to deal with these issues of what are reasonable under the circumstances. And is the surface owner, in fact, trying to enhance the value of the surface estate to the complete detriment of the mineral owner? So that's self-dealing, so that the surface owner obtains a value through the use of the executive right that the mineral owner does not hold.
Who owns the executive rights in this case, or does that matter to you?
Who owns the executive rights in this case?
Blue Green and the lot owners.
Blue Green owned the executive rights. It did not convey the executive rights to the lot owners, but it has subsequently conveyed all of its executive rights to the Property Owners Association. Our position is that the various deeds to the lot owners did not convey the executive rights, because those deeds accepted from the grant all rights to develop minerals, explore for minerals, which the court has said, the Eastland court said, the executive right and the development right go together. So if you have accepted from the grant, as if all those words were stuck in the deed, it's not subject to, it's accepted from. If you have accepted from the grant all of the ability to use the property for oil and gas development, then Blue Green reserved the executive rights.
But without explicitly saying so, they, as a practical matter, they reserved the executive rights.
Well, I understand that the Court of Appeals held in the respondent's argument that what really happened here is that this was an exception by implication, mm-hmm. and that is frowned on at law. But really, this is no different than the prior cases where the courts have said, when you have accepted leasing rights, we are going to interpret that to mean the same thing as executive rights, because you have defined what the term is. That's exactly what happened here. They didn't use the word executive right, but they defined it. So there's no exception by implication. It was done expressly. And to further answer your question, Justice Green, as far as who, whether the duty exists or who, and whether the duty was breached, it makes no difference who actually owns the executive rights, because the executive owes those duties to his mineral co-tenants.
And ask you further about that, the point Justice Green raises, because the CA, as you mentioned, held that Blue Green conveyed that interest, and it was not specifically accepted out. Further explain this, your argument that Blue Green somehow retained it, and it was not a retention by implication, it was otherwise.
Right. 2 points. First, Justice Wainwright, I would like to say that there is no question that on this record that Blue Green did own the executive rights at the time that the restrictive covenants were put in place. So at the time that we said there will never be leasing of the property, there is no question that Blue Green did that while it was the executive. Now, when Blue Green did these various deeds to the lot owners, what those deeds say is that we are accepting from the grant the terms of the restrictive covenants. It's not subject to the restrictive covenants. We are accepting from the grant. So if you take all of the words that exist in the restrictive covenants, it's as if they are typed into the deed. So we are accepting from the grant. In other words, we are not giving to you the right to develop the minerals by any form or fashion, whether through leasing or self-development. So since we have not given you that right was retained. It's not by implication, it's by definition.
Why should the executive rights be severable from the mineral interest if they really, if there's not much to them?
Well, there's actually a whole lot to the executive right, Your Honor, and let's not...
I'm not following that, because it seems to me, under your theory, that if you've got a fiduciary duty to look after the best interest of the mineral interest owner, that's pretty well ties your hands.
Well, let's not forget, though, that the fiduciary duty that this court has articulated with regard to the executive rights is not the full fiduciary duty. It doesn't entitle the full panoply of fiduciary obligations. The fiduciary duty it's really a small F fiduciary duty instead of a big F, because the executive right owner does not have to subordinate his interests for the interest of the non-executive as if it was a full fiduciary duty. But the executive can't self-deal, and the executive has to acquire the same benefits for the non-executive that it gets for itself. So here, for example, in this case, the Court of Appeals has articulated that the restrictive covenants would not be enforceable but for the fact that Blue Green held the executive rights. So the restrictive covenants don't work unless Blue Green held the executive right. But implementing the restrictive covenants is not an exercise of that right. Well, the two don't go together. If the restrictive covenants are only enforceable because Blue Green owned the executive right, then that must have been an exercise of the executive right. And Blue Green did obtain benefits by using the executive right that its non-executive mineral owners did not get. And
what is the law of other states? Do you know?
The law of the other states is, I believe, somewhat divided, and I'm happy to do post-submission briefing with more detail, but it's my understanding that, for example, Louisiana has a statute in place that says that the executive does not owe a duty to lease. However, it is my understanding that other courts have adopted the standard as articulated by...
Mangus.
And, well, Professor from Texas Tech, I'm sorry, Professor Kramer, and then Amicus from Williams and Myers, where he has said that the executive duty at the very least has a standard of do no harm. And so other states have adopted that standard, and we would be happy with post-submission briefing to answer that question in more detail.
So the scope of the duty is?
The scope of the duty is exactly what is articulated in the jury charge of Mangus versus Guerra, and that is exactly what the trial court here found, and it is that the owner of the leasing rights owes to the non-executive mineral owners the same degree of diligence and discretion in exercising the rights and powers granted under leasing rights as would be expected of an average landowner who, because of self-interest, is normally willing to take the steps to lease. One of the arguments that has been articulated by the respondents, and I've started referring to it as the widows and orphans argument, is, my goodness, this is going to be a horrible standard to place on unsophisticated strangers that don't know how to do leasing. Well, first of all, there's no evidence in this record that we're dealing with unsophisticated strangers. We know that we are dealing with mineral co-tenants, and the law has always said that co-tenants cannot commit waste of their other co-tenants' interests. So this duty that was articulated and adopted by this court back in Mangus versus Guerra provides a very workable framework to deal with all of the various exigences and circumstances that exist, whether you have a sophisticated executive or an unsophisticated executive.
Can you explain, if we do impose this affirmative obligation to lease, how the traditional right of the executive owner to exercise substantial discretion in dealing with the mineral estate would be affected?
Well, I would take slight issue with the description of having substantial discretion, because the substantial discretion is limited to the executive does have discretion, but the executive must do no harm.
Right.
And so I think the duty that the court has already adopted has worked well since 1984. There have been various courts of appeals cases that have articulated this very duty, Havlinka, Mims, and Pickens versus Hope, and it's worked fine. And there's, the sky has not crumbled in oil and gas.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
Argument for the respondents. Ms. Bernie Wolben with the first 13 minutes. May it please the court. My name is Laura Burney, and I'm here on behalf of the respondent, the developer in this case, Blue Green. I must begin by correcting some of the mischaracterizations of the law. You notice in petitioner's argument you did not hear about the case that answers the question. That case is your decision in In Re Bass. In Re Bass expressly says that there is no affirmative duty to lease on the executive. As Justice Heck has pointed out, the whole point of the executive right is to allow those with that right to control leasing. There has never been a case that has interpreted Mangus as imposing an affirmative duty to lease.
But Mangus itself awards damages for failure to lease.
Yes, that did end up being part of the damages. That's true, Your Honor. But there is nothing in that decision. As this court said in Bass, we would ask this court just to stick by your decision in Bass. That decision very clearly says that the difference between this case and Mangus in the Bass case was not a difference in the type of interest. The difference was in Mangus and in all the cases since Mangus, there had been leases, and that is what triggers the duties of utmost good faith and fair dealing. I would like to answer.
I understand your position on Bass, but what is the answer to, besides Bass, to why or how damages could be awarded in the Mangus case for the part, not the self-dealing part, but for the just the non-lease?
Well, in the Mangus case, which of course is an example of a very notorious case creating some difficult law, it was so egregious there that the court used the fiduciary standard, and they were looking for a way to figure out what damages would have been if, since he had leased to himself, how could they come up with damages. I would like to also point out that counsel for the petitioner relies on the jury charge in Mangus, which this court has never expressly adopted. And even if it did, if you read that jury charge, it expressly refers to the exercise of the affirmative duty to of a duty to lease. It does not impose an affirmative duty to lease. And that is something that this court expressly recognized in Bass. We would have to go back to Danziger v. Powell, Danziger Oil Company v. Powell in 1941. That is a case that this court cites in Bass to clearly state that an executive owes no affirmative duty. In Danziger, there was a deed from the Powells to an oil company. In our case, we have a deed from some individuals to a real estate developer. It was known that it was a real estate developer. The mineral owners kept a small fraction of the minerals, and they expressly conveyed in the deed the executive right to this real estate developer for $2 million. The reason we are really here today, Your Honors, is that these petitioners seek to rewrite the deed. They do not have the executive right, and they are sorry that that's the case.
But it wouldn't make any difference to your case, as I understand it, if they had retained all of the minerals.
No, it would not. What is key is the executive right. The executive right has always been the stick in the bundle that completely controls leasing. This court and all commentators have consistently made that point. That's evidenced by the majority rule that this state follows, which is this: no matter how small a fractional interest in the minerals I own, I could own a 1/1000th of the minerals in Blackacre. If I keep the executive right, I have an absolute right to lease those minerals. The executive right is the key. You don't keep them, you cannot lease.
Can a current executive rights owner be permitted, or should they be permitted from prohibiting a future executive rights owner from forever developing the property?
An executive rights owner has the executive right, Your Honor. They have the full duty to lease, and it is their decision. It would be a shock to a lot of ranchers, farmers, and residential developers out there who reserved the executive right for the purpose of facilitating and protecting their surface estates to learn that they suddenly have an affirmative duty to lease.
But would they have the authority to prevent future executive rights owners from developing the property?
No, Your Honor, if the executive right passes, an executive rights owner can exercise the lease. And I would also like to address, Your Honor, there's a lot of sky is falling, rhetoric here. producers are used to encountering very difficult mineral titles. Difficult mineral titles is the rule, not the exception in this state and all states. What do? They have to negotiate rather than litigate. And that will occur if this court does what it has always done. In Bass, in Moser versus United States v. Steele, in Danziger, in Heckey v. Neal. In all these cases, this court has refused to rewrite deeds to change the party's bargain.
Does anything in the record estimate the value of the surface estate?
You know, Your Honor, we need to correct some of the record about what the record says about the value of these minerals. We're making a lot of speculation here. This is not a case where there's been a lot of leases to these lot owners who are now the executive right owners, and they've turned them down. There's not even any evidence that this is really worth producing at $7 gas. That is all pure speculation. We are here today to ask whether or not these lot owners have an affirmative duty to lease. Court answered that question in Bass.
What if a neighboring tract is draining the reservoir? Everybody sees it happening. Still no duty to lease?
There's no duty to lease. There is no affirmative duty to lease, no. What would happen there is this is where, if you keep the property rights clear, these lot owners have the mineral rights. It's a typical example of a problem in a chain.
Hands are tied.
Pardon?
Their hands are tied by the restrictions.
There are deed restrictions in place, but as always, these are typical deed restrictions, and deed restrictions that prohibit mineral drilling, that is very common, that is not against
public
policy.
And they can overcome that with a sufficient vote.
Pardon?
They could invalidate that restriction if they all
absolutely, that was
together.
Going to be my point, Your Honor, that these are completely amendable, only two-thirds. It is hyperbole to say that these minerals had been, quote, condemned. And then that leads me to another case and another mischaracterization. This court set forth the mineral estate dominance rule in Getty Oil versus Jones in 1971. The rule is not that the mineral estate in the state of Texas can be developed at all costs to all surface use. This is what the court said in Getty Oil v. Jones. Oil and gas estate is dominant over surface estate in the sense that the use of as much of the premises as is reasonably necessary to produce the minerals is impliedly authorized by the lease. But rights implied in favor of a mineral estate are to be exercised with due regards for the surface. In Getty Oil, you had what we don't have here, a mineral estate owner with the executive right who had leased. And what this court said is, yes, you've got an implied easement to produce, mineral owner, because you have the executive right, but you must also show due regard for the surface. So it all comes back, Your Honors, to the fact that this is a case where they do not have the executive right. They cannot change that. I would like to answer.
Even if executive right owner has no duty any more than no self-dealing, why should he be permitted to restrict the future use of the executive right by means of these deed restrictions?
First of all, Your Honor, I don't think it's exactly clear to say that they have restricted the future rights.
There's some restriction on them.
Absolutely. It is not against public policy for a residential developer to buy property and develop it for a residential use. They have exercised their property rights. Unlike Mangus, we don't have anyone here who has abused their rights. This was an above-board deal. If in Danziger Oil in 1941, where this court absolutely refused to imply any type of duty for an oil company grantee to develop the property, it certainly makes no sense that this court would imply an affirmative duty when a real estate developer bought the property for $2 million. If the court's going to impose such a duty, to answer your question about other jurisdictions, we address it in our brief. We would be the only jurisdiction to do so. Our neighbor to the east, Louisiana, with which we share a huge prolific producing shale, the Haynesville, has an affirmative code provision that says an executive has no affirmative duty to lease, but if the executive undertakes to lease, it must do so in good faith. That appears in a Louisiana code because that represented stated law. That's also the law of Texas, Your Honors.
Why would you convey the executive rights and retain the mineral interest if you have no control over developing it?
There is no downside to it, Your Honor. For these mineral owners and for the developer, since they got the executive right, they may be motivated by self-interest someday too. That is always the case when property rights are clear. In the event that they do choose to amend their their property restrictions, which when they have 3/8 of the minerals, as they do here, that could very well be, if we ever get into some facts about what these minerals are worth, which we do not have in the record, then these people benefit. They got their $2 million up front. They'll share down the road with their cost-bearing mineral interest.
Has there ever been an attempt by petitioners to persuade or cajole or buy out the executive interest of all the lot owners?
I don't know.
Or to persuade a sufficient number of them to invalidate their restriction?
I don't know of any. I don't believe that's the case, Your Honor, but you do raise a point that negotiation has always served producers well. They have run into worse burdens in a chain of title. An example that's frequently written about is when a producer goes out in the chain of title, they know they cannot change the deeds in the chain of title, and they find in there a very large interest, either mineral or royalty, that entitles that outstanding owner to, say, 1/2 of all the production coming out of the ground. In that instance, no producer can afford to produce. What can they do? They can't rewrite the deed. They know that. They must go to that interest owner and negotiate for the benefit of both parties. So we urge this court to stand by your decision in Bass, which very clearly said whether or not the non-executive interest is a non-participating royalty or a non-participating mineral, there is no affirmative duty to lease in this state. Alternatively, Your Honor, there has never been a case in this state that has imposed an affirmative duty to lease. And contrary to Mr. Acock's representation, none of the commentators have viewed this state as imposing an affirmative duty to lease, including the Williams and Myers treatise he quoted. If you were to do so, it would be such a sea change in the law that you could only do so prospectively. Property owners have relied on the use of the executive right to protect their property. In that instance, you would have to follow what you did in Moser versus United States Steel, where this court overruled the surface destruction test and adopted the ordinary and natural meaning test, but felt like they could only do so prospectively.
Well, you say a sea change, but what did people do between Mangus and Bass?
Mangus has never been interpreted as imposing a very strong affirmative duty to lease. When Mangus came out in 1985, the confusion about Mangus was, why did the court use the fiduciary label when, since Schlieder v. Smith in 1937, the court had always used an utmost good faith? Hancock in Havlinka v. Hancock, which is a post-Bass decision, one of several out of the Court of Appeals that have relied on this court's decision in Bass, and one in which this court denied review, the court did a very good job of reviewing the law since Mangus and said that all the post-Mangus cases had dealt with instances when an executive had abused the leasing power and had gotten leasing benefits that were unfair to the non-executive. For example, there are cases where an executive negotiated a surface damage payment in a trade-off for a lower royalty.
Real quick, if we were to find there is a duty and there was breach here, what would be the remedy we ought to fashion?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, if you were to find a duty, as I said, that would be a new law. I don't think there isn't any evidence in this record about that they've turned down leases or there's nothing like that in the record. There's supposedly a letter of interest. There's nothing like that. You couldn't even do that here, Your Honor.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning. I'm Stephen Haynes, and I represent a good number of the individual lot owners that have filed originally the appeal and now are respondents in this particular matter.
Did you get a deed like the Court of Appeals said there were 1,700 deeds? It's the one the Court of Appeals quoted.
Your Honor, I would presume that many of my clients did receive deeds that were similar to that in form. There were, I think in the affidavit that's in the record, there were 5 or 6 different deed forms that were used, but the one that is referenced in the Court of Appeals decision is one of the most common.
Why, when you read the exception, number 3, that referred to a 1/4 mineral interest that had been reserved, doesn't that at least inject some confusion as to what was reserved back in the Bluffdale deeds that the Court of Appeals seemed to think was clear from the beginning and therefore limitations had run?
Your Honor, I think when you look at that, the fact that Blue Green may have mischaracterized the deed, it also has a deed reference in there to the actual deed itself.
Right. But I mean, it shows, looks to me like that Blue Green at least thought of Fourth had been reserved.
Certainly, but the fact that Blue Green may have mischaracterized the prior reservation shouldn't affect my client's rights. I mean, the prior deeds say what they say in regard to the specificity of the
land. Right, but the Court of Appeals said, well, this is clear as a bell. That's why limitations is not told and the discovery rule doesn't apply. But it was not clear as a bell to Blue Green that was deeding all this, all these lots to people. And I, since none of the lot owners ever popped up and said, wait a minute, it's not a fourth, it must not have been clear to them either.
And the reason I'd like to point that out, I think the court's raising a good point in this sense, but one of the important things to understand about, and one of the reasons I raised my alternative argument in regard to the reformation issue is this. In order to reform the deed against my clients, you have to show that all of my clients had constructive or actual knowledge of the mistake in reformation. So you can't allege on one hand that the deed itself is ambiguous and therefore I didn't find the mistake, and then turn around and say, but every subsequent purchaser had a constructive knowledge of it. It's either inherently undiscoverable or it's not. If it's inherently undiscoverable, there's no way I had constructive knowledge of the prior defect, and therefore the deed could not be reformed, and the Court of Appeals committed no reversible error. I would point out, Your Honor, that from the beginning that my clients did nothing but buy a lot on which they thought they were going to build their home. And having done nothing more than buy a residential lot and build a home, they find themselves being sued for millions of dollars.
Do some want to lease?
Your Honor, I suspect, and I think it's a good question, I suspect there are probably some of the developments, maybe even some of my own clients, who would lease under the right terms. And that's really the whole point of this.
But they're not going to be able to.
Well, they could execute non-surface leases today.
Sorry, now?
They could execute a non-surface lease today and not be in violation of the restrictive covenants in any regard. So I suspect under the right terms, certainly there are many lot owners who would be willing to lease. And that's really the whole point of the case, is that under the current law, they have the discretion to decide when those terms are right. If the law were to change, they would not have that discretion.
Do you think the lot owners have the executive rights, or does Blue Green?
I do believe the lot owners have the executive right, Your Honor. And I want to point out, I think there's a real fundamental problem with the plaintiff's argument. And this is, and they go to say, well, you reserve the executive rights by filing the restrictive covenants. They misunderstand the nature of a reservation. If I'm reserving something, it means I'm reserving it unto myself so that I can execute a lease. Well, if the restrictive covenants prevent leasing, how is that a reservation? Blue Green can't execute, if my clients can't execute a lease, Blue Green can't execute a lease. I fail to see how they're calling that a reservation, because it doesn't retain anything under Blue Green to do something that my clients could not also do. So, and I would point out that as a Texland case and the Court of Appeals held, unless the executive right is specifically reserved, it then passes on to the grantee. I think as, go ahead.
Have there been efforts at all to, as I asked the other respondent, have there been efforts to persuade lot owners to either band together in sufficient numbers to invalidate their restriction or to cajole them into?
The efforts were, if you don't give me your executive rights, I'm going to sue you for millions of dollars. And there were many of my clients who got a letter from the appellants in this case that said something, or I'm sorry, the petitioners in this case, that says something to the effect of, you owe us millions of dollars for failing to lease your home, but if you'll simply execute this deed, giving me your executive leasing rights, then we'll let you out of the lawsuit. But to the extent there was any effort to obtain the executive leasing rights, that was it. And I would point out that if this court were to create a duty to lease, we're going to see a lot more of that.
Do you have any idea what the combined value of the surface estate is across the lots?
Your Honor, I really don't. I can tell you at one point I did a quick math on the appraised value of my client's interest, which was well in excess of $12 to $15 million on just my few lots.
Petitioners apparently indicate something about $610 million worth of minerals.
Your Honor, I think that's pure speculation. First of all, assume that there's even minerals there. Everyone in this courtroom knows that there are oil and gas promoters that go around and do seismic data and tell you there are millions of dollars in gas beneath the soil, only to subsequently drill a dry hole. I would also point out, if you read that affidavit closely, you'll find that it's based upon gas trading at MCF of about $7, and the last time I looked, gas was trading at MCF of about $2. So there's definitely a some fluff in that number that was there.
You represent about 460 landowners, is that right?
There's about 460 who have appealed, and I represent the largest portion of those, Your Honor. I don't represent them all, but we did jointly brief it for the benefit of the court, not having to have multiple briefs.
Is there a public interest here in preventing waste or encouraging development that cuts against your position?
Well, I think the public interest is to ensure that people that bargain for a certain benefit get the benefit that they bargained for. And in this case, the benefit was we purchased the discretion to decide when and on what terms to lease. I'd also point out, if the court were to create a duty to lease, my personal opinion is that would decrease the values of minerals in this state. Because as the court has pointed out, what's going to happen is a land developer is going to come to a landowner and say, you own the executive leasing rights for your co-tenant or for this other individual. And you know what? If you don't execute this lease, then you're going to get sued by your co-tenant. Now, is there going to be any negotiation for oil and gas lease under those circumstances? And the answer obviously is no. People are going to be forced to lease their mineral interest at substantially less rates than what they could bargain for because they have no negotiating power. It becomes purely an administrative function with no discretion to negotiate for the value of the minerals.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court. I'd like first to talk about several different items that have been mentioned that I think call for further discussion. In this record, there is, and not that this is determinative, but that it is a fact. We have expert testimony in an affidavit that the value of the minerals under this property could be as much as $600 million. That's not just speculation. There was a prior well drilled on this property to the Marble Falls formation that was productive of gas, but there wasn't an infrastructure pipeline, so they abandoned it.
Was that at the $7 or the $2 trading?
Well, it depends, of course, upon the value okay. of the dollar. Back
so
at that time, it was about $7.
Okay.
I think now at $5, whatever. But many millions of dollars. But in that well, they did a log, and there's 160 feet of Barnett shell under this acreage. We have expert testimony in the form of an affidavit, no contrary evidence at all. We have expert testimony that the formation is such that you would expect it to be generally over the whole property. There was a study done of wells on an adjoining county to support that view, but that's what the evidence is. The surface question was asked about the surface. The surface was sold for $500 an acre, surface and minerals and whatever went with it. The second thing, a question was asked about well, if you reserve a royalty, don't you really anticipate that might be beneficial to you someday? As in Schlittler, which in 1937, the court didn't have any problem with that. It says a reservation of royalty on all oil, gas, and minerals which may be produced necessarily implies that the grantor contemplated the leasing of the land for production. One of the fascinating things about the oil and gas business is that you can sit here with a piece of property today with minerals that you don't think much about. And tomorrow, because of advanced techniques, formations that were earlier unproducible have suddenly become producible in the Barnett Shell, in the Eagle Ford. To reserve minerals does mean something. It does mean that you have an expectation that if the opportunity arises, the value of your minerals will be realized.
But what if you don't? What if the purchaser of the executive right says, I'm going to buy this, and I'm never going to lease this property? That's my firm intent. So you don't have that expectation.
That would be the result of affirming the Court of Appeals opinion in this case. And there are several things that would be consequential that would follow that. The first is, I own minerals that today are worth to the 8/8ths on the order of $450 million. You are my co-tenant. We are co-tenants. You have a duty not to harm my minerals. But if you have the executive rights, you can make my minerals valueless. You can determine that I'm at your mercy. The other thing that I would say about that, and it's interesting. If all you say is that an executive who, and the executive's rights are acquired in different ways, through inheritance, through partition, family gets together, they've inherited minerals, they say, you know, how are we going to deal with these things? Well, they try to find one person that knows something about executive rights, about leasing, about oil and gas, and they say, you be the one, so we'll give you the executive right. Tomorrow, that guy says, you know, I don't think I'm going to follow through on this. I think I'm going to not exercise the executive rights.
And I can see that that's where it comes up a lot of times. Is there much, are there many commercial transactions that involve just the executive rights?
I'm not aware of any. Ordinarily, though, there's nothing improper. One, you want to keep the executive rights unified in some source to make it easier to lease. One of the reasons that you give the executive rights or would sell the executive rights to the surface owner, aside from the fact that through the courts you have some confidence that if you give him the executive rights, he's not going to do harm to your interest, but is going to protect it if he has an opportunity to do so. The surface owner, within the framework of Mangus's duty, and within the framework of Getty that provides the way that you measure and these conflicts and deal with them to make an accommodation theory, because of that, there's nothing wrong with the guy giving somebody the executive rights to so that he can obtain further protection than he otherwise would be entitled to.
Sir, can you discuss their last argument, sort of a policy argument, that if we create a duty to lease, that it's going to restrict the value of land, and that's the end of negotiations, you know, it becomes purely administrative, I'm going to force you to lease that. Can you discuss?
I'm sorry, would you say it once more, please?
I can.
Justice.
The last argument that they made was that if the court creates a duty to lease, that will restrict the value of the land, and that it really sort of turns years and years of the way things are normally negotiated on its head, if you will. Can you respond to that? Why we should create a duty to lease, if you will, to the extent it's not already there?
to say that a duty to lease imposed on an exec right holder would decrease the value of the property?
Restrict, yeah, because...
I don't quite know how to respond to that, because I don't think that's pure speculation as to whether it would.
Tyke, if I could ask one brief question along that line. If you can be sued for your neighbor or your co-tenant's belief that you should have leased at $3 and you think it's going to $7, and that could generate a lawsuit claiming you did not act reasonably, why would anyone ever want the executive rights when you could just sit and second guess them and backseat drive them, so to speak, and threaten them with lawsuits?
You would want the executive rights so that you could add additional protection for the surface, bury the pipeline no more than 300 feet from a residence. But
aren't you subjecting, if your theory is there, aren't you subjecting every executive rights owner to blackmail, so to speak, by their co-tenant, threatening them with lawsuits?
I think that the situation situation would be that those there may be a disagreement as to whether or not a reasonable person would lease or not. But that's the very question that courts are set up to deal with. And that could well be. But the reverse of that is, if you enter into a lease and you didn't get enough money or enough bonus, I as a non-executive mineral owner, I can sue you. However, if you follow what the Court of Appeals has said, if you, instead of entering a lease that is unfair where I'd get something, say I'm not going to enter a lease, then I get nothing and my value is destroyed.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Dine. The Chief Justice is recused in this case. The case is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.